Welcome to Cross Defense on this Monday in June the 23rd. I'm your host, Pastor Rod Zwanitzer, welcoming you to this unique program where we talk about apologetics, intellectual discussion about questions that are valid in minds of all ages. My guest today has been on with us before, Craig Parton. He's an attorney, an apologist, a trial lawyer, would you say, Craig?
Yep.
And that's important to our topic today because we want to talk about an essay contribution that Craig had to a great book, Making the Case for Christianity, published by CPH, Responding to Modern Objections. And in this collection is Craig's essay on lawyers, trials, and evidence, investigating the resurrection of Christ. Now, as a trial attorney, why do you think there should be a legal investigation of Jesus' resurrection? And you write about that it should be of more than passing interest to all of us.
Yeah, I think it's for a few reasons, Rod, that lawyers have been attracted historically to Christianity because Christianity begs to be refuted. Its initial adherents were people who said an event happened, a historical event happened, that could be checked out. They asked people to produce the body to refute it. They wrote specifically that if this event did not occur, the entire faith is in vain. There are no answers. You might as well live in hedonism. As one of them, Paul said, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Paul would have been a flat-out hedonist if there had not been a resurrection. He wouldn't have been a moral holding to some kind of vague natural law. If we're extinguished at the end and there's nothing else but dust left, get what you can now, for tomorrow you die. So lawyers have been historically very attracted to Christian faith, and I think it's of interest to people in terms of apologetics, because lawyers historically are not exactly considered to be friends of religion. So they can't be accused of being naturally religious or naturally predisposed to be coming out in favor of the Christian faith in their analysis. So when lawyers turn their professional acumen on the events surrounding the center of Christianity, I think people will take notice that this isn't being done in order to prove a point that they've already accepted, not on evidence, but that they've been looking at the issues from the perspective of facts and evidence. And secondly, not only are lawyers not naturally religious or known to be friends of religion, so I think that's attractive to people looking at how they look at the resurrection, but secondly, lawyers are interested in facts. And Christianity is a faith based on fact. It is founded on fact. It is not founded on feeling. I had somebody tell me recently, and they were wearing a clerical collar and very pious. They told me, there is no evidence for the resurrection. I said, well, if that's true, you're not a Christian. And he was highly offended at that. And I said, no, you're not. You're not a Christian. If there is no evidence for the resurrection, our faith is in vain, you're a fraud, you're wasting people's time, and you should shut your church down. And that's precisely the way the New Testament looks at the issue. So lawyers have been interested in facts, in evidence, in what indeed happened, not in presuppositions. Lawyers seek to try to prove the most and are allowed to assume the less. When I go in front of a jury, I am not allowed in most cases to tell the jury to assume something happened. I have to prove it. So they're interested in facts. That's the second thing about lawyers and investigating the Christian faith that's of interest. First is they're not naturally religious. Second, they're interested in facts. And third, lawyers go for a verdict. They don't allow things to sit in nebulous philosophical speculation, discussing how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, or what was God doing before time was created, other philosophical speculations. We leave that to philosophers. Lawyers look at the evidence and see if the evidence calls for a verdict. And in the presentation of the faith by the apostles, they clearly move for a verdict. They call people to believe this message that they heard of the perfect life and atoning death of Jesus Christ for the sins of the world and his resurrection for their justification, and call people to believe and be saved. So they don't leave things out there. Every trial ends in either a judgment by the judge or a verdict by the jury that's turned into a judgment. It's not just, you never come to a draw. You come to an answer, and that's what Christianity calls people to.
Craig, while we're there, as I was listening to the points that you were making, it reminded me that, you know, we're really getting on a playing field that attorneys like to operate on, and it's the way they, I think, naturally think. Not only that, but in apologetics, we should remind people that the first people that were shown the evidence for Jesus' resurrection, they just didn't take it by blind faith, by somebody, by telling them, yeah, you should. They were shown the witness and the evidence, and that's what you're going to outline for us, that you line up the credible evidence and you take all the cross-examination of that evidence, which is healthy and good. This is really crucial and good stuff for the people of God to hear and to consider, and then we would encourage them very much to start using this in their outreach and their witness.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that Lutheran theology is Christocentric and incarnational in its essence. It is all about God coming to us, how he's coming to us in the cradle and the cross and in the sacraments. And you want an apologetical method that centers on the center of the case for Christianity, Jesus Christ. And what you want to avoid is buying into an apologetical system that requires you to prove 25 other things other than the central case for Jesus Christ, because you can win 25 irrelevant arguments, but if you lose the discussion with the non-Christian about the deity and resurrection of Jesus Christ, you've lost at its heart. So apologetical systems that require people to first, for example, prove the existence of God in a theoretical position, I think are less than satisfactory. So you want a Christocentric apologetic that is completely consistent with Lutheran theology. In fact, the best Christocentric apologists, I think, operating today are Lutherans, because that Lutheran focus on what God has done for us in the person and work of Jesus Christ is absolutely central to Lutheran dogmatics and should be central to any apostolic defense of the faith.
Amen. And this book really brings that out, that your essay is a part of, that, you know, what's distinctive about Lutheran apologetics is we go right to the heart, Christ. And so this resurrection allows us, when we share with someone else, that Christ is the very center of our faith as he should be, and not let them take us off on tangents that are biblical and important, but they're not the core. And we get a chance to share Christ crucified and raised for people's sin forgiveness. So, you know, what I think too, Craig, and you can probably bring this out more than I can, those of us that have been on a jury as a part of a trial like I have, and the rest maybe that have had the you know, enjoyment and knowledge builder of watching trial on TV, a real one, you get very quickly the importance of, would you call it the rules of evidence, what evidence right. is going to be allowed, because I can remember we were totally, so many times, ushered into the jury room, and we all knew without them telling us what they were going to fight over was admissible evidence.
Yeah.
And we came back in, then we found that out. So talk to us about this admission of evidence, especially as it pertains to the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Well, the center of any trial is evidence. There is a dispute about some fact, and a trial is simply the recreation of that event and a determination of what happened, and then what is the proper interpretation of what happened. And in a court of law, that is done in an adversary system. That is the Western legal system. It is not followed in all countries. Continental legal systems in certain European countries do not have an adversary system. They have a system where the judge is actually involved in finding and collecting evidence himself. You might recall when Princess Diana died in Paris, the judge actually went to the scene of the crime and or the accident to accumulate evidence themselves. That is unheard of in the Western legal system that emphasizes an impartial finder of fact, either a judge or a jury, and an advocate on both sides presenting evidence for the position and contrary to the position. So the elements of a trial are, other than the opening and closing statement, are the presentation of evidence of pro and con by the competing parties, and then ultimately a verdict or a judgment by the trier of fact or the jury. And the centerpiece of that is evidence. And the Western legal system, an incredible amount of energy has been put in to taking great care to protecting the nature of the evidence that is admitted to the trier of fact, so that reliable evidence is allowed in and not hearsay. What's hearsay? Hearsay is evidence by somebody who didn't see the event. That is very much frowned upon unless the evidence can be verified by other sources, or unless the person who is giving the testimony is subject to criticism or cross-examination about his ability to have recollected correctly the events or not. In general, people that are not eyewitnesses are not, in general, not allowed to testify. An apologetical point on this, for example, the Quran, written in 7th century A.D., has a number of statements about what actually happened concerning Jesus Christ, whether he died on the cross or not, that absolutely contradicts the first century eyewitness testimony that you have of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, who are either eyewitnesses or close associates of eyewitnesses who checked out carefully everything that they said. No court of law would ever listen to the Quran and what it says about what happened in the first century AD to Jesus Christ.
In that, Craig, if I could stop you and ask you this question, would the other attorneys challenge that on the basis of what reliable evidence do you want to enter this? And and you're saying there would be none that would be acceptable as permissible evidence?
Oh, it would be very simple. If Muhammad tried to get on the witness stand and testify about what actually happened to Jesus Christ at the cross, that it was a different person there, it'd be very simple. I'd ask the judge to excuse the jury while I asked a couple of questions of Muhammad. First question would be pretty simple. When were you born? And the second question would be, you're obviously not an eyewitness 700 years later. I'd ask the judge to strike the testimony, and there isn't a judge who wouldn't allow it, who wouldn't allow me to strike the testimony, I mean. He simply is not an eyewitness. You don't rely for historical information on somebody's view 700 years later. It's the same with the critics of Scripture in the 20th century and the higher critics of Germany telling you that actually the resurrection didn't occur. This is what actually occurred. Well, the fact is you weren't there. We need to cross-examine the witnesses to see if they had the means, motive, and opportunity to get the story correct. They're the ones on trial, not somebody who figures out, well, maybe something else possibly happened. Lawyers and law courts and trials are not interested in possible explanations. Anything is possible. They're interested in the most probabilistic explanation of the events that takes into account the most number of facts. And so trials are interested in finding out what happened, even if what happened is a one-in-a-lifetime cannot be recreated event. It's a unique historical event that's never happened before. The judge isn't going to disallow evidence because it seems like the result of the evidence would be incredible. The judge is going to say, did you have the opportunity to get this story right? What did you see? Did you have the means to see it? Were you under the influence of some drug or medication or alcohol or for some reason under a psychotic delusion? Those are the kinds of questions the court would ask. And then once the facts are established, what is the best interpretation of those facts? That's what every court of law does. And generally, in a court of law, there's determined to be one best interpretation of the events that took place. The law does not hold to the concept that all interpretations are equally valid. There is one best interpretation, and it's the interpretation that bubbles up from the facts. it bubbles up from the ground up. You don't impose interpretations in the law from the high heavens and then make every fact fit into the grand theory that you have. Theories and interpretations have to be are only as good as the facts that support them.
And when you sit on that jury, as I did, we were continually admonished and encouraged to only think and consider what had been presented before us. Don't take your own spin, go to your own conclusions. Just you have to make the judgments based on the evidence that was brought before us. So that is the criticalness, is it not, of the admission of evidence, is that if a juror or a judge is making a verdict and they can only base it on the evidence that was brought before them.
That's exactly right. And another apologetical application of that, Rod, is the so-called Gnostic Gospels that come second century at the earliest, Gospel of Thomas and others, that give a different picture than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John of what actually occurred. And those, again, are late sources. They are not eyewitness sources. There is no external archaeological or other evidence to support that they got the story right or that they were eyewitnesses, and no court of law would allow them in. So only in theology do you have people using the Gospel of Thomas to make people think that the events actually in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't take place. No court of law would ever, ever allow a jury to consider Thomas as authoritative, the Gospel of Thomas authoritative, about what happened in those original events in the first century.
Craig, I find that you write so well. Maybe it's your legal training, but anyway, you're a fine wordsmith, and several sentences that you have in this essay just really caught my attention. I'd like to have a comment on this. Christianity is fact-centered and therefore welcomes, indeed insist upon, careful and thoughtful examination.
Yeah. Well, you get this from the book, all over the book of Acts. Acts 26, you get it, Paul and Agrippa and Festus, where essentially at one point, I think it's Festus says, Paul, your great learning is driving you out of your mind. But at one point in Acts 26:26-28, basically the response is, you know what? You've almost persuaded me to become a Christian, because Paul's approach was, this didn't happen in a corner. If you don't believe me, talk to the 500 witnesses that have seen the risen Christ and go grab the body from the tomb and end this nonsense now if it didn't occur. Set us all straight. But the apostolic witness was, this man was raised from the dead. His body is not with us, and we saw him. And we're pretty good. We have pretty good testimony of people that are competent to tell whether someone's alive or dead. I mean, sometimes you hear the argument they didn't know what they were seeing. They were seeing an apparition. Well, it's recorded that that they not only saw him, but they had to be convinced it was him. Thomas wouldn't believe. In John 20, 28, he had to be brought to that confession that this was indeed Jesus Christ. He would not listen to the women's testimony that they had seen him in his post-resurrection appearance. Thomas said, unless I see him and put my hands in his side, I will not believe. And Jesus honored that. Now, he did say to Thomas, you know, you should have believed the eyewitness testimony of the women. You know, Thomas, would have been a good idea to do that. But be not unbelieving and believe. And Thomas confesses the deity of Christ, where he says, my Lord and my God, after actual tactile confirmation that the resurrected Christ was there in his full post-resurrection glory in physical form. I mean, this is Jesus Christ appearing. He could be recognized. Certainly his body had unique unique properties, could pass through doors. That's kind of cool. and some other unique properties.
Could be in under and with and around bread and wine.
Yeah,
I mean, pretty easily
yeah.
If he could do that other stuff.
Yes, yeah. But he's still clearly recognizable. So anyway.
Craig, you know, I think you're making such an important point for our apologetics. I mean, we're not just having some intellectual fun here. We're talking about how real Christians like you and me and everyone else, you know, it seems to me, and I'd like your opinion on this, that too many Christians do not realize how historical Christianity is, and that there is this valid evidence that we can hang our hat on and have to, as you started the program off, and therefore we can share it with other people. And as that statement said, we don't shy away from cross-examination and evaluation of the facts. In other words, we relish that, and that's where Christianity can really come forth. Now, when you talk about in the book, we need to be certain what we mean by this, proving the case for Christianity, and in particular, as we're talking about here, Jesus' resurrection. Unload that for us a little bit.
Yeah, I think a lot of times people have, when they hear the statement that Christianity can be proven, that they get the wrong impression of what we're talking about when we talk about evidence and proof. In a trial, you are required to come to a conclusion that it is more likely than not, that's the civil standard, preponderance of evidence, that the event occurred, or in a criminal case, beyond a reasonable doubt to a moral certainty. That doesn't mean to a complete certainty, because facts always are probabilistic. That is, you may have gotten something wrong. It's possible that the story is incorrect. It's possible that that something else may have occurred, but based on all the evidence that we have, a jury's instructed that the best explanation, for example, in a criminal case, is that the defendant did the crime. And based on probabilistic evidence, a verdict is reached, a decision is reached, and that decision is 100% executed. In fact, a person can get the death sentence, and it's not based on absolute proof. It's based on probabilistic evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. So non-Christian can never ask whether the case for Christianity is absolutely certain. No factual case is ever absolutely certain, but you have to act every day in life based on probabilistic reasoning. People get surgery every single day based on probability, not based on certainty. As much as your doctor would like to say they've diagnosed everything certain and that they're certain that this is the right result and the right way to approach it, there's always room for error. There's always a possibility that they got it wrong, but you have to decide. If you've been told, look, you need this surgery to save your life, to say, well, that's a factual issue and there's probability reasoning and it's possible that they're wrong, I should do nothing and make no decision, and then you die. All of us have to make life-changing and life and death decisions based on probability evidence. So that is critical in the law, that people not get the idea that we're talking about putting Jesus Christ in a test tube and getting 100% certainty. Our God is a person. A Trinitarian person. He entered human history in the form of a man. He lived in a specific period of time, had an address in Nazareth. These are things that can all be checked out historically. And the historical proof is always probabilistic. And in terms of Christianity, the case for Christianity is as strong as ever needed to prove a criminal conviction, that's for sure, beyond a reasonable doubt. I think people need to recognize the fact that our case is strong and need to be encouraged that whenever they're talking about the case for Christianity, they ought to be talking to a non-Christian about what the evidence is and encouraging a non-Christian to check out that evidence, to read the primary source for themselves. For example, read the book of John.
That's very good. And we're going to take a little break and we're going to come back and dwell again on this point, because you're making a huge point here that we need to make sure our listeners on. So stick with us. You're listening to Cross Defense with Craig Parton. We'll be right back.
My name is Rebecca. After fleeing Sudan and spending years in a refugee camp, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service placed me with a foster family in the U.S. I couldn't have survived without a home, friends, and community to embrace me. Every refugee needs help on their journey. Nobody can do it on their own. For 75 years, LIRS has transformed over 500,000 lives through ministries of mercy and justice. Go to lirs.org/KIT to join us and work with refugees like me to brighter tomorrows.
Worldwide KFUO is the most trusted place for sacred music of the church, where every night of the year you can hear sacred music. Weeknights at 6 p.m., listen to sacred music on AM 850 KFUO in St. Louis, as well as streaming online at kfuo.org. Our online stream is in high-quality stereo, so you can hear the difference wherever you listen, on your computer, on Wi-Fi radio, and on your smartphone. We're Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Thanks for sticking with us here on Cross Defense. We're talking with Craig Parton, Lawyers, Trials, and Evidence, Investigating the Resurrection of Christ. Craig, you are a part of a wonderful event. I hope someday I'm blessed to be able to attend it. Tell us about this wonderful conference in France that you and Dr. John Warwick Montgomery are such an important part of.
Well, every summer in July in Strasbourg, France, we hold an Academy of Apologetics that brings together four faculty in the defense of the faith and 20 individuals that are registered to get advanced training in the defense of the faith in different areas, from philosophical, scientific, historical, legal, apologetics, legal medical issues in apologetics, world religions, etc. We've been doing this for almost 20 years. The classes are all in English, and next year we fill up very quickly. We started almost 20 years ago with a handful of people. We have a maximum number of 20, and next year it'll be again the same time, July 7 to 18, 2015, and our guest instructors will be Rod Rosenblatt, who you may have had on your show before.
Absolutely.
And Dr. Oliver Wilder Smith, who's one of the foremost both PhD, MD, defenders of the faith and scientific apologetics in the world. So it'll be a fantastic academy, a great time. And people, if they're interested in checking it out, should go to apologeticsacademy.eu for Europe and check out our website.
We're going to put a direct link to where they can get this book that your essay is in. And also, Craig, when we took the break, we were talking about the importance of, you know, an advocacy legal system where there is a two-sided legal debate over the interpretation of the evidence. And while we were off here, you and I were talking about my jury experience, and I was saying that I saw this in reality, that there the advocates were giving us two different interpretations, two different mega stories about where these facts and evidence should lead. And I remember being on the jury, there was a couple of key pieces of evidence that did not match up at all whatsoever with the story from the defense. And so it was pretty clear to us who was trying to pull the wool over our eyes. And they did that with a lot. This is kind of where we need to go with the apologetic for Jesus' resurrection.
Yes. And let me mention something. When you say every trial has two sides, a listener, a sensitive listener, might say, well, who's the other side on the resurrection? I mean, didn't these guys just present this case and there's nobody challenging it on the other side? To the contrary, there were people with built-in, highly motivated positions to refute this case for the resurrection. Effectively, there was the opportunity for these Christian first apostles and followers of Christ to be refuted, because the Roman leaders and the Jewish religious authorities were, both of them, in places where they were motivated and had the means and the opportunity to refute this new nascent religion if they could produce a body. And in fact, they couldn't, and instead were creating stories about the disciples stealing the body, etc., or people under a delusion that continues to this day. But you look at what the best interpretation of the evidence is. Is it more likely than not that these disciples actually stole the body and hid it and tried to pull off a great concocted story because they wanted people to believe it. Then you have to believe that the disciples died martyrs' deaths for what they would have known would have been a lie, which is highly unlikely. And then, of course, they're writing about the importance of truth-telling, so they would have been complete hypocrites. They would have known that they were hypocrites. This is not the picture that you get of the New Testament testimony. You have the story of people who had to be convinced themselves that this resurrection took place. These were not gullible people. These were people who had given away all to follow Jesus. Now he had been crucified, and they were back to fishing before dawn. I mean, they were not interested in creating martyrdom for themselves if this had not occurred. And in fact, their testimony is, this man appeared to us directly. We saw him. We touched him. He talked and operated in very different ways amongst a period of 40 days before he ascended back to his Father. And we're telling you, this man has verified his claims to be God in the flesh. His claim in John 8:24 that if you don't believe in him, you die in your sin. And that he could verify this incredible authority by rising from the dead, which he has done in clear history.
So these eyewitnesses did not pursue any book deals to make money off this or appearances on, you know, speaking tours or such. In fact, as you meant, they kind of go back to their ordinary life, and then they're even threatened with persecution, and most all of them meet up with that. So, I mean, to me, that's pretty convincing evidence. And that's a part of a trial, is it not, too? Because back to my jury experience, one of the key witnesses for the defense was the sister of the defendant. Who had totally different interpretation of some of the evidence. And the when she was cross-examined, she was exposed, I think highly exposed, as having motivation to change, to embellish, you know, some her story, and you know, I know as the part of the jury, we picked up on that.
Right, exactly. You do not get any sense from these early witnesses that they were into a wealth and prosperity gospel of any type. They are completely riveted on the truth and the centrality of the resurrection. They are not telling people you'll have a better life, you'll get wealth and prosperity, nor do you find them running around picking on the Roman secular culture for its gross moral laxity. They are preaching the resurrection of Jesus and his death for the sins of all people, and they turn the world upside down, even though they were operating in a completely secularized pagan situation. That you don't find this moralistic kind of preaching that you find today so much in America. You find these people saying, you know what I'm going to talk about? I'm going to talk about Jesus and him crucified for the sins of the world. And that's the sins of all of us. We're all beggars in need of bread.
Amen. Talk to us briefly, Craig, about the reliability of the New Testament documents, since there we really have the resurrection of our Lord, and how we can present this to people that need to hear this evidence about Jesus.
Yeah, we do this in a course on historical apologetics at the Academy, and I'll just say very briefly, it's critical that the reliability of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John be established, because if they are late historical records that come centuries later, written by people that were not eyewitnesses, then our picture of Jesus and the events surrounding his life and death is eroded. And it is critical that we establish as a first point with the questioning unbeliever the reliability of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And by that I mean that we establish that they are primary eyewitness sources to the events that they record, that they come early, that the writings are written on top of the events that they record, and that the number of copies that we have give us confidence that what we're reading is what was originally written. that work has been done by a number of different apologists. Certainly I've done it in and it's done in that book Making the Case by Mark Pearson on his article on the reliability of the New Testament. I've done it in Religion on Trial. John Warwick Montgomery teaches at the Academy, has done it in his book Law, History, and Christianity. And the great book on it is F.F. Bruce's The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? It's still a classic.
It sure
in the
is.
Field. And the result of that is the New Testament Gospels are the best attested works of all antiquity. If you want to throw out Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as reliable history about the life of Jesus, you might as well eclipse all knowledge of the ancient Latin and Roman world. And this is the conclusion of even critics of the Bible. Bart Ehrman says the best sources on Jesus are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They are primary source. They come early. Now, Ehrman says they got the picture wrong. They're stating incorrect facts, etc., and there's all these variant copies, etc. But he is the first to admit, you throw away Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you might as well throw away any picture of Jesus. Whoever you think he is as good as what I think he is, which is as good as what Rudolf Bultmann in the 20th century thinks he is. If we're going to throw away primary sources, all of us get to speculate. And that's the destruction of the historical record if that happens.
A valuable point for us Christian apologists to share that far more reliable, according to the standards of these historical documents, than like the annals of Julius Caesar. And so classic literature departments all over the world would be instantly vaporized if they throw out these as being unreliable, because as you say, when you look at the evidence, these are far superior than other documents of antiquity. So a good point. When we talk about getting this Jesus, Craig, before people, putting him on trial. How about this you call it a pesky topic about a missing body? And we even hear in some murder trials that there is a trial and evidence and sometimes verdicts that are based on they never did find the body.
Yes. The mafia has been very good over the decades of making bodies disappear, and that hasn't stopped getting convictions for murder. I mean, they've never found Jimmy Hoffa, but they've prosecuted the people that were involved in the case. So this happens all the time when people can't find a body. The question is, what does the evidence state and lead to the conclusion as to what happened with that body? And most importantly, when it comes to the resurrection, we have evidence that Jesus was alive at point A. We have evidence that he was crucified at point B and died. That evidence is as solid as any medical evidence you could have for the death of a person. It's been analyzed over and over by medical professionals. I have the footnote drops in that article in Making the Case for Christianity and also in Religion on Trial. And so we have solid evidence that he lived, solid evidence that he died at point B, and then we have, from the same reliable witnesses, we have solid evidence that he was seen alive again over a period of 40 days. And we call that a resurrection. And the fact that it has never occurred before, nor has occurred since, doesn't change at all the fact that the evidence is clear that this is what happened. The church calls it the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It explains the most evidence about his appearances, and this comes again in the solid record. These people were able to tell whether someone was a ghost or not, and Jesus was not a ghost. He was there with those wounds as, from the best that we understand, he has to this very day. We know he's still fully God, fully man. He retains that fully human nature even to this day, and will show those glorious wounds to all the redeemed on that final day when we are with him reigning forever. That is how human and tactile this resurrected Christ is. I mean, when the apostles first found him on the beach, when he was cooking up cuisine au poisson, a grilled fish there. They knew exactly who it was. I mean, Peter is, oh my gosh, it's the Lord, got out of the boat and started running to shore. There was no doubt this man could be recognized and that they were in their right minds when they did so. And any other explanation has to account for all the other facts. And the stolen body, or that he was deceived, or that they went under a psychological hallucination, have been found wanting. Hallucinations don't occur to masses of people over long periods of time who come from differing backgrounds. It's unlikely that the doubting Thomas had a hallucination that this was true. He didn't want it to be true. He didn't think it was true. He was back to his occupation, and he had to be brought kicking and screaming to the resurrected Christ based on the admissible evidence.
We should interject here, too, that Jesus not only predicted this, a bodily resurrection and not just the appearance of his ghost, but he also talks about our resurrection.
Yeah.
For believers in a body. And a lot of times Christians fail to, get that. They think it's just like a spiritual body floating up in the clouds. No, he promises a resurrection body just like his. So that's important. Craig, let's ask you this question. Why would a resurrection prove Jesus' deity, his being the second person in the Trinity?
That's a good question, because a person listening to this may say, I agree, the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, so you prove to me they're reliable. Okay, you prove to me that in them Jesus claims to be God in the flesh. Okay, I see that. I see that he verifies his claims to be God in the flesh by resurrecting from the dead. Fine. But that doesn't prove his deity. I think the response to this is sensitive non-Christians realize that the central question of man is death. The true enigma, this is recognized by all sensitive authors, writers in literature, the French existentialists, others, that the ultimate question of life is, why do we die? And it seems so irrational, it seems so final, that if anything, if God actually came to earth, the one thing we would want him to answer is the question of why do I die, and what happens after I die? And Jesus answers why we die, because we're in human rebellion to God and have been from the beginning. And what happens after death is, for those who believe in Jesus Christ, based on his finished work on their behalf, they live forever in his presence. To the thief on the cross today, and the thief on the cross didn't have a lot of theological knowledge, he would have failed the most basic catechetical examination. But he knew one thing. Jesus was going to his eternal place, and this guy was going to link himself to Jesus' merits. And Jesus said, today you will be with me in paradise. There's no purgatory. This is the thief on the cross. This is not a higher and better life this guy's lived. So we get directly from Jesus this kind of affirmation that his resurrection explains his ability to be victor over death. And if there's anything we would want a miracle, the resurrection, to link directly to a victory over death. Now, could Jesus have said, I'm going to show you that I have victory over death by curing hangnails? I suppose he could have done it that way, but there would be a lot of us thinking, you know, that doesn't exactly show victory over death to cure my hangnails. But very few people can sustain an argument that, you know, if not the resurrection, what do you suggest he should have done? If not victory over death to prove he was God, what's your plan B as a better idea? It seems a little embarrassing at a certain point to argue that his resurrection doesn't prove his deity.
When I was preparing for this yesterday, Craig, I came across that sentence in your essay that if God were indeed to come to this planet as a human being, what would he really want to give us insight? And I love that. You say the enigma of death, and I'm I'm preaching on that this Sunday. And yeah. so I interjected it in because, in essence, we all know that physical death is on the horizon for us.
Right.
And we fear that moment. Some fear it more than others. And so Jesus likes to talk about it, you know, and sometimes we Christians get accused of wanting to talk about fire and brimstone, you know, hell and heaven, death and eternal life. But Jesus goes right to it so much as the rest of the biblical writers, because it is our major concern and problem. And the resurrection of Jesus Christ, historical, for every individual, is has to be where it's at.
That's exactly right. It comes right out of the text, Rod. I mean, Jesus, I am the resurrection and the life. He who lives and believes in me will never die. That's, you know, I am the way, the life, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. I mean, this exclusivity comes from his own lips. It's not something created by the church. You just read the text, and this man believed he was God in the flesh and believed that his resurrection showed his victory over death. And the point is that he's in the best place to explain what that resurrection means, because he accomplished it. And he says, it shows that I'm exactly God in the flesh who I claim to be, who I asked you who I was when I was on earth. And Peter finally confessed it, that I was the Messiah. And I said, you're exactly right. That's precisely who I am. And I'm going to accomplish victory over death. You know, the Bible doesn't answer a whole bunch of questions that humans' curiosity has, like, you know, how to fix my computer or a whole host of things. It just answers the most important things.
You know, I love in the book of Deuteronomy. It's Deuteronomy 29:29, before the Lord, you know, takes Moses to his grave. Moses declares, you know, I'm going to paraphrase it. God has all the secrets, but he's revealed enough to you and to me to know that we can be saved. And that's what you're saying. That's the essence of the revelation, the Bible, that Jesus came to save us from our sin and give us a resurrected body to eternal life. Craig, let me ask you this question that people might ask of both of us, so I know you can answer for both of us. Isn't this just your spin, Craig and Rod?
Yeah, the question is really, isn't this just your interpretation? And the fact is, we want to get aligned with the best interpretation of this event, and Jesus gives us the interpretation. We're sticking with what his interpretation of the event means. And his interpretation is, it shows that I have victory over death and am God in the flesh. And if anything, if you have a choice between picking one person's interpretation or another person's interpretation of the resurrection, go with the interpretation that is close to the person who accomplished his resurrection as it can be. And the fact is, Jesus tells you, he has come to die for the sins of the world. He didn't come to live the moral example so that you could be a Jesus to your fellow man. He came to live a perfect life, as he says, as Israel's atoning lamb, who has come to seek and to save that which was lost, and could pay the only price as the sinless Son of God, perfect redemption and crucifixion and resurrection for what we could never accomplish on our own. And this is not a matter of our interpretation. And frankly, the early Christians got this, and basic Christianity gets this. All the creeds confess the resurrection of Jesus Christ as the center of the Christian faith. Nicene, Athanasian, Apostles' Creed are all the central creeds of Christianity and are confessed by Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, and Protestants. So all of us together have, if you're at anything considered an Orthodox Christian, and as you hold to the ecumenical creeds of Christendom, that is the interpretation. He died for the sins of the world and resurrected on our behalf. That's not some oddball thing that Craig Parton or Rod Rosenblatt thought up. It is the confession of the ancient church and the apostolic band.
Absolutely. And so when you know, challengers to that, such as the Mormon Church, try to say, well, we're the new Christian church, and we have a better revelation. They don't have any evidence for this. So this is so vital. With just a few minutes left, Craig, tell the audience why it's so important for them and for us as well to be steeped in this evidence for Jesus, this historical evidence for Jesus in the Bible, so that we can share it with those that desperately need the salvation, the grace and mercy that comes in Jesus Christ.
Well, Christianity is unique in that it is evidence-bound. It is a faith founded on fact. That's what makes it unique. When we degrade our Christian evangelism to outglowing other groups or trying to show that we give a better lifestyle or more success or we make happier people or we make families more together, we are really prostituting the gospel message. The central message is that the evidence speaks out that this is true, that this man is who he claimed to be, and that he did exactly what he claims in the New Testament record. And we should keep that evangelism and that gospel presentation to things that people can check out themselves by reading the Book of John and reading good apologetical work that presents that evidence to them, rather than degrading the faith into, I believe it because my life has changed and I now have a song in my heart. Well, the non-Christian can't check out whether that's true or not. And frankly, a lot of other people have songs in their hearts because they're doing yoga or because they're Mormons or Jehovah's Witness or Scientologist or Islam or Baha'i or any number of religions that will give you all kinds of feelings. You need to look. The primary questions of Christianity are truth questions. They always have been. Christianity is centered on the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the truth of that claim.
Craig, thanks for sharing that truth and that witness today with us here on Cross Defense, and we look forward to having you on again soon.
Oh, my pleasure, Rod.
God's rich blessings on your service to our Lord.
Thank you. Same to you.